We can now settle down so that we can start. Just want to double check if we all have a copy of the agenda in front of us. We all have. If you don't have, could you please show by, indicate by show of hands so that we can give you one. Looks like we all have a copy of the agenda that will be assisting us or guiding this meeting. In terms of the agenda, we are on item number one, which is opening and welcome. I'd like us to observe a moment of silence for prayer or meditation. Thank you. Well, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, greetings to you. I would like to welcome and extend my greetings to the honorable members of the committee, the hardworking support staff, the chairperson of the Financial and Fiscal Commission, Professor Daniel Plassey. Thank you very much. And your presence means a lot to us. And your delegation. More importantly, warm welcome and greetings to our esteemed guests. Because of the open democracy, we also expect members of the general public, you know, to show interest and attend. They are also allowed. So thank you very much if you are here. The objective of the meeting today is to receive and discuss the FFC submission for the 2019-2020 Division of Revenue. This is a requirement in terms of Section 4, subsection 4 of the Money Bills Act. So it's a compliance issue. Today's meeting gives us the space to be innovative and proactive about how we deal with issues that are provided for in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, equitable shares and allocations of revenue between the three government spheres. Or spheres of government. As we approach 2019-20 financial year, how do we ensure that we adopt a division of revenue bill that carefully responds to the constrained fiscal environment? As we walk this tight rope, how do we make sure that we do not lose sight of the goals we set ourselves in the National Development Plan? So as we grapple with these complexes but equally pertinent questions, I invite honorable members to carefully listen and constructively engage the FFC on its submission for the 2019-20 Division of Revenue. Thank you very much. You are all welcome. I would like us to move on to item number two, which is apologies.
Good morning, honourable members. We have not received any apologies this morning.
All right. There are no apologies. So we'll then move on to item number three, which is presentation by the Financial and Fiscal Commission. You will then register all those who are absent as absent. Yeah, thank you very much. Oh, we also have the PBO. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us. Over to you, Doctor, or Professor.
Good morning, Chairperson, honourable members. Thank you very much for the opportunity again. I have to just to let you know that I'm running between two committees. I just started with this basic education, and there are lots of issues that are going to come through there. So I'm going to flip out and luckily we got a continue here. I don't know whether this is the first time that he's going to engage with this committee. Dr. G. Brown is the secretary, he's on the FCC's new CEO.
Okay, thank
and
you very much.
The,
congratulations.
The accounting officer of the FCC. You have seen her before because she used to work in National Treasury as a chief director for expenditure planning.
And then the budget comes up.
And the budget.
Yes.
Next to her is on Suya, who's a working Suya Daura, who works in the office. Cheng Tei, who's in, also working in the office, is one of our research people. And then we have Kopi Saka, who's working in the research team. And for the first time, we're also meeting Sisim Kize, who's our chief financial officer. Tisle is standing in because we have a forensic report that has suspended where the commission has suspended our CEO for alleged impropriety. So Tisle is the person that's our CEO here, and so that's the team. Kay will be the team when I leave. Just to let you know that the submission is we're looking at the... Is there no bicycle today?
Looks like we're not going to have a bicycle. I'm going to have. Okay,
okay.
So they're sorting it
all
out.
Right,
so we'll have one.
The theme for this year is to... For the next year, 2019-2020, the Division of Revenue is re-engineering the intergovernmental fiscal system in a fiscally constrained environment for national development. The submission essentially focuses on the review of the effectiveness and performance of the current intergovernmental fiscal relations system. And we make a couple of recommendations with regard to re-engineering the fiscal instrument. We'd like to put to you some of the incentives and other measures that we think need to be addressed to help with the National Development Plan objectives. Just a reminder that three previous submissions, the one was the infrastructure growth, and then 2 years ago we did the rural development and the urban development, and Chairperson, the reason I'm raising that those three, it's becoming more and more of critical nature that it doesn't matter how we get the vote and the appropriation of those votes. If we don't invest in economic and social infrastructure, we can kiss growth, economic growth and development in the country goodbye. Because those investments are the ones that actually incentivizes investment, domestic and foreign investment, but on the other hand, it helps to contribute to the Human Development Index of our country. And then the third thing is it helps with employment. So what we would like you to do, and I'm asking you, please, it's no longer a situation where we just pretend and go away. And it's coming up in every province that we're going to. It's also coming up in every committee that we're seeing. That if you don't see infrastructure investment in the budget votes of departments nationally, and even when you see the province as a whole, then I can say to you now, employment will not be created. So you're basically just carrying on in the same vein, maintaining the same status quo, and as a result, the poor will remain poor because the budgets help people to live in muck, so they love it. We help them to live in muck so they can actually love how to live in muck. And I think part of public finance and part of spending the taxpayers' money are multiple fold, but in particular when you come to a country like ours, where you have the Gini coefficient fluctuates between 67, 8 to 70%, showing the deep levels of inequality and deep levels of poverty. And poverty is man-made. Poverty is man-made because we have historically policies that created poverty for black people in general. But we passed that stage now. So we need to be able to see how the appropriations, and I'm speaking specifically to your committee on this, how the appropriation actually delivers on the democratic dividend. But the commission is concerned, and I think that the general public of the country is concerned that they don't see the democratic dividend. The poor remains poor. The poor, in fact, the levels of poverty is going deeper. You have people that are experiencing shocks in their households. A husband dies. They might be living in a middle class area. The wife never worked. The wife is on a social grant. And then you don't see changes in the rates that those people are paying, whether it's electricity and water. But moreover, you also don't see the democratic dividend delivering to them, because our social policies and our services want people to be poor. You know, the moment somebody sits in the house and they get a social grant and the house was built out of the pocket for years, then we say, no, but those people can't, those persons can't get a social grant or social benefits or basic services. In reality, there's a shock, a huge economic shock to the household, where there's no income coming in. And it happens across the country. It happens across the country, so we need to be able to see how the appropriation the department brings to us actually address the issues of poverty. It's not about maintaining the salary levels of... In fact, studies have shown in the country that the only people that's not going to suffer and bite the bullet in terms of the economic implications that we're going to experience again for the next 18 months with a slow growth are civil servants. Some of them are sitting in this room, some of them are sitting outside, some of them are going to come and present their budgets to you. The people that's going to suffer the most is those that work in out of the public service, and also those that are struggling themselves to make ends meet. So we need to think about differently how do we use the appropriations process of budgets and our recommendations that we've given to you over time. Provinces are asking us what's the impact of your recommendation. The one committee asked me what's the impact of your recommendation, and I said no. We're presenting to you as public representatives. You should actually check what's the impact. You should actually check whether people are actually looking at our recommendation. And some of the justifications that's been given. You have departments appearing before you, and I would love to have a conversation with the chairperson and the support staff so that we can, when you call them, we can say to you, these departments that haven't responded to our recommendation. They just ignore. But they know that the task in front of your committee and other committees are huge. But we are available to tell you. And we're not doing rent-seeking with your committee. We're available to tell you in no uncertain terms who are the departments in those votes that actually has never responded to the recommendations of the FSC income over the period. Whether it's human settlement, whether it's transport, whether it's social development, whether it's... there's a lot of them. And it's actually just a solidification and the maintenance of their own budget. And the same we can do with the provinces, so that you as public representatives are better equipped to, from our perspective, because of the information that we put in front of you, to be able to engage in it. So this whole idea about re-engineering the intergovernmental fiscal system is essentially to show to you also how the system has been constrained to be able to deliver on the national development objectives. We either believe in the national development plan, we know it's not legislated, or we don't believe in it. But we can't have a situation where we talk RDP, and then we talk about Asgisa, and then we talk about whatever, NEPAD, I don't know where NEPAD is running now, but we talk about NEPAD, and then we eventually talk about the National Development Plan. We need to be able to draw exactly one of those things which this obligate department to deliver on. Because departments will come and tell you the rosy story about what are they doing, and they also allow the ministers and ministers to talk about these things, about how the National Development Plan is going to work and what they're going to do. But in reality, their budgets, their votes, their policies, the legislation they introduced to you, to I almost wanted to say to you guys, sorry, to the Honourable Houses.
I wanted to call you out of
the Honourable Houses of the Parliament, it doesn't follow that. So there's no follow through on that. And it's quite critical that we need to look at it. So we would want to talk to you on the re-centralization, the implications of service delivery. The provincial adjustment mechanism, in the case of half what's going on in the health sector, the incentive effects of intergovernmental grants, and assist how it affects municipalities, because we're in trouble when it comes to municipalities. Not the metro, but the other 240 odd. We are in serious trouble when it comes to that. We're going to talk to you about the case of education, health, and public transport. And then with the challenges around water, and hopefully we haven't just debated whether we had a water crisis. We don't have a water crisis. We just know that we are a water poor country, an extremely water poor country. We will take you through that, and hopefully, Chairperson, before the presentation is done, I'll be back to back with you from the basic education, because I only got one sparkle on the other side, and it's a little bit. Thank you. Can I hand over to Dr. Kate to take it through?
Well, thank you very much, and we understand that you have to attend to the two committees, but thanks for coming and also for the, you know, for setting the tone for your presentation. Thank you, Doctor. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and members. I'll dive straight into chapter one. Chapter one makes the case for re-engineering the intergovernmental fiscal relations system, essentially looking at the fast performance of the economy due to economic growth and other economic statistics, and doing a forecast to project forward in terms of if we maintain the current trends and structure in the economy, where would that get cut? And our conclusion then is that given the fiscal constraints that are built into the economy as it stands, these will place a limitation in terms of the policy development of our country and addressing particularly poverty and inequality and the equitable sharing within that. So essentially using that econometric model, we look and try and project the level of growth that we would need in order to make a structural shift, and particularly focusing then on aggregate consumption expenditure and how that consumption expenditure then, when there's an increase in that, what the distributive effects would be of that, and how that then would affect different sectors in the community and how it would impact on poverty particularly, and also on hunger more specifically, which is obviously a more intensive definition of poverty. Looking then at those sustainable development goals, which is to halve the poverty, we take it down from 55% to about 27%, and we eliminate hunger, which is currently set at about 25%, if we look at the poverty line. So since 2008-09, the global economic and financial crisis, we've had a slow growth in South Africa. We all know that.
initially in 2009 what's now called the 2009 Great Recession. Initially when it happened it wasn't called that, and there was a debate as to whether it was just sort of a temporary state, and I think we all now know that it was a structural break in the economy in terms of the growth and the growth pattern. And subsequent to that, particularly subsequent to about 2013, the fiscal framework has taken a very visible knock, and we have the narrowing fiscal space, and of course that, I suppose, is narrowed so much as the negative fiscal space now. If we look over at the graph, we can see that in terms of our growth performance and where we come from and projections, if we make no intervention, will be very similar. You can see that South Africa, which is the red bar, we're not doing very well relative to the rest of the world, emerging markets, or even sub-Saharan Africa. And just for example, in 2017, 201,000 new job entrants, and we only managed to absorb 102,000. So if we continue having that level of unemployment, I suppose it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that poverty and inequality cannot really be addressed. So what has happened in terms of our budget? Well, what's important from a budget point of view is the budget deficit, which is the difference obviously between spending and revenue take. And obviously in South Africa currently we have a higher level of expenditure than revenue each year. The key thing is to try and manage that budget deficit down. Currently that budget deficit grows annually, and we need to get to a point where the deficit reduces and ultimately, I suppose, reverses. In the budget that we see in the recent past, we see that in each of those projections, the date at which the budget deficit would eventually start getting smaller is pushed to the outer years. So what that means is that increasingly we're funding interest payments. And that doesn't even mean we're paying a cent on the debt. That's literally just service, the interest. And in fact, in the current financial year, that's estimated at 170 billion rand, which obviously relative to the departmental budget is extremely large. So fiscally speaking, we are in a conundrum. We have revenue under collection. The revenue under collection last year was 36 billion, for example, and a narrowing tax base. Yet we have an overextending government structure in terms of departments having increasing priorities, and we also have an increased number of departments, and yet we also have budget cuts, which are not quite as much as the revenue under collection, but then that's not good news necessarily, because then that means it adds to the budget deficit. So the key message of our first chapter is that clearly business as usual is not going to work out for us in the foreseeable future, and that we do need to address policies and the interventions if we really are to tackle poverty and inequality. We have to focus on making a structural change and on fighting poverty and inequality, but we also need to be mindful of the fragile fiscal framework. So we need to do that in a way which is growth and development engendering, but also is not a threat to the fiscus. If you look at the numbers in the econometric modeling, essentially what we need to do is take the growth of about 2% up to 4.5%. We need to increase the investment, and I believe the chairperson spoke to the reasons for specifically why one would want to focus on investment spending. And certainly a cause of concern for the Commission is the cuts that have taken place in government spending in general, but particularly also as it pertains to infrastructure. Yes, from a technical point of view, there has been underspending on infrastructure budgets, so it seems to be a good candidate is going to need to be cut, given the spending that's taking place. And also that it's the kind of spending which potentially could be rescheduled. But on the other hand, it is critical that we have infrastructure spending to ensure and for growth going forward. But more importantly, in terms of consumption spending, our numbers in our econometric model tell us that consumption spending needs to increase by about 2.5% per year, and particularly then the distributional effects of that need to be assisted by about a 10% increase in social grants. Then if we do that, our predictions are that we will be able to impact particularly the rural provinces, and that there also needs to be a focus on skills development or higher skills employment. So there would have to be some sort of intervention in that regard. So that is on a high level, I think, our rationale for re-engineering generally from a macro point of view. Then in the other chapters, we go forward looking at different aspects of the budget, and particularly at the structural changes that would be required, and the changes to the fiscal instruments and intervention. I'm now going to hand over to Mr. Singh, and between him and Nthaka, they'll continue. Thank you.
I'll take you through chapter 2 and chapter 3 of our submission.
Chapter 2 of the submission concerns decentralization, as Jen has already said, where decentralization is essentially a reform that brings about a reduction in the autonomy of the sub-national government. So basically it refers to an increasing role and control by national government. An example of decentralization of all the national government expanding its footprint would include the shifting of functions from the sub-national government to the national sphere. Or in a financial sense, it occurs when there is a reduction in the autonomy of the national government over the fiscal resources. So when we start seeing an excessive use of conditional grants relative to the streams of revenue that a sub-national government would have discretion over. So now, decentralization is often based on the perception that the national government is better at service delivery or ensuring that results are achieved. And from our analysis, it appears that governments are more prone to decentralization during periods of fiscal stress. However, decentralization has various ranges of concerns. And one such concern is that it runs contrary to the spirit and principles underpinning multi-level system of government. And say, if it was the case that the national government were expanding its role or its footprint, and the result was improved cost-efficient service delivery, and this was happening alongside the upscaling of the national government capacity, then maybe we could argue that there is a case a larger role for national government is justifiable. And then another concern is that the relocation of a function comes with definite financial implications for both the sphere gaining and the one losing. So the key question of this chapter looked at whether decentralization is then a solution for South Africa during times of fiscal stress. Will it lead to better performance and better service delivery? And to answer this question, we focused on two case studies of decentralization. The first one, we looked at earmarked conditional grants, which is essentially a ring-fenced pocket of funding within a conditional grant that has very strict conditions attached to it. So essentially, it reduces the autonomy of sub-national governments over fiscal resources. And we looked at two examples. We looked at the finance-linked income subsidy, your FLIP program, and upgrading of your informal settlements in mining towns. And in the second case, then we looked at the T-grade colleges, where T-grade colleges were relocated from the provinces to the national increasing control. So moving on to the next slide. In terms of key findings, broadly speaking, there has been a slight change in the way in which government responds to any kind of fiscal debt. So if we look at the graph below on the slide, if we look at the period post the 2007-2008 financial crisis, we see that national government footprint is expanding, which is evident in the strong real growth of the conditional grants relative to the more muted or even declining growth in the block grants or the discretionary funds such as the equity and debt. And then when we now look at the period from 2015 or 2016 up until the current MTF, which is also characterized by low growth, the response is quite different. We see that block grants show a more positive growth relative to your conditional grant funding. But the interesting bit is that while the number of conditional grants has not grown rapidly, what we start seeing is the growth in the number of earmarked conditional grants, which, as I said earlier, are the pockets of funding within the existing conditional grants that have stringent conditions. So, in a sense, it can be seen as a more subtle approach to centralizing the fiscal control over your sub-national government. And then, moving on to the next slide, the second finding relates to the earmarked fund within the human settlement related grants. And with respect to the spending and the service delivery performance, our analysis found that national government is not necessarily better, thus then bringing the question bringing into question the rationale behind decentralization. So, for example, with the FIS, we saw that high levels of underspending, in, I think in 2016-17 it was around 76%. And similar performance for the grants on the upgrading of informal settlements in the mining town. In terms of service delivery, the performance, the mining town grant showed that in 2016 or 17, only 41% of the targeted sites were upgraded. And then in terms of our third finding, which is then derived from our case study on the colleges, as you will remember, the colleges were relocated to the National Sphere in 2012. We evaluated the efficiency of these colleges prior and post to the relocation of the function, and we found that yes, there were colleges which were inefficient previously to the reform, but post the reform, then they did improve. However, worryingly, is that there were a number of colleges that were efficient whilst they were still under provinces, which have now seen a decline post the reform. So implying that taking a blanket approach to a reform is not necessarily ideal, as it can negatively affect the performance. So based on these findings, we propose three recommendations. We propose that in the current constrained economic environment, with given our limited resources, government should not automatically resort to using the role of national government. And then the second recommendation is that to improve service delivery and attainment of specific priority outcomes, control measures other than the implementation of earmarked conditional grant funding must be developed and strengthened. And then in terms of our third recommendation, we say that when re-centralizing a function is deemed necessary, a differentiated approach must be adopted. Then if I may move on to the next chapter, which is chapter 3, it looks at the provincial fiscal adjustment mechanism in the health department. And in understanding that your provinces play a crucial role in the delivery of primary health care, with allocations comprising between 30-35% of the total provincial budget, what we see is that your provincial health budget and health departments appear to be under severe pressure as a result of massive healthcare demand coupled with poor growth and transfers. With it is estimated that current health budgets are underfunded by 15 billion in 2018. So then in the context of the existing tight fiscal environment, which then places healthcare delivery under severe pressure, this analysis asks what means are available to provinces to respond to the ongoing strain. And the first thing we did was then to assess the existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements, assess whether existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements provide scope for provinces to adjust their budgets in times of fiscal constraints. And then what we find is that, firstly, a sizable portion of the provincial revenue is made up of earmarked national transfers, which hampers the ability of provinces to adjust their spending priorities in line with fiscal position. And also existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements also limit the scope for provincial borrowing and revenue measures. And as you know, your provinces have a limited revenue raising powers and functions relative to, say, your municipalities. So all in all, your existing intergovernmental fiscal arrangements limit the ability of provinces to adjust their budgets in times of fiscal constraints. And secondly, we then want to assess the extent of fiscal stress on the provincial health department. To do this, we use the budget balance as a measure, and generally where budgets are under stress, we would see a negative budget balance or overspending, which would then be indicative of stress. So the figure on shows the provincial budget balance for the three provinces, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Eastern Cape.